Today is Thursday, March 31st, 2005. Monica Brown, our legislative fiscal officer, is with us, and so is Kat Bell, our subcommittee assistant. For the record, I'm Representative Greg Smith. Today we are going to have a public hearing on House Bill 5063, the Public Utility Commission. With us we have Commissioner Lee Beyer, who's chair, Rick Willis, the executive director of the Public Utility Commission, and we have Satish, I'm going to have
Apadje.
Yes. Got it. Our DAS Budget and Management Division. Welcome, gentlemen, and for the record, if you could introduce yourself, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and I have with me Rick Willis, who is our Executive Director.
And I'm Satish Apadje with the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, we are at your pleasure as to how to proceed. What I did do at the conclusion of yesterday's meeting, you and other members listed five things that you wanted to talk about. And I would note that we also have not gone through or had the opportunities to hear DAS's comments on the budget. So I'm at your pleasure on that. The five things, and I put some material at each of your positions up there. One, you specifically asked if we could start off by talking about the Energy Trust and give you some background, and we're prepared to do that. You wanted to have the committee have some time to provide the commission with some guidance on performance measures that, from the legislature's perspective, made sense to you in terms of setting some expectations
right.
for us, and we're very happy to hear your guidance on that. You wanted some more information on our retainer agreement with the Attorney General, and Mr. Willis is prepared to talk to you a bit about that. You also asked for a little more detail or an example, I think is the word you used, on a small water company and how they operate. And then finally, Representative Richardson wanted to talk a little bit about span of control issues.
Perfect. Well, why don't we go through one through five? Then if there's any other issues you would like to wrap up with, we can do that. We'll go into a public testimony, if there is any. We'll give it about another 20 minutes and see if anybody comes storming through the door having to testify on the Public Utility Commission. And then we'll go to Satish for the governor's recommended budget. We will not be having a work session today, as we'll be doing that in the very near future. So why don't we start with 101 on Oregon Energy Trust.
All righty, Mr. Chair. Let me start out with that. Where this comes from, and I'm going to step back a little bit for those who aren't familiar, and I actually frankly think all of you are, but if you go back to 1999 and Senate Bill 1149, which was the somewhat controversial at the time, discussion on restructuring the energy industry in Oregon. Part and parcel of what was then a very finely crafted, artfully crafted, if you will, bill among consumer groups, environmental community, industrial users, and utilities was something we called the public purpose charge. The public purpose charge funds a number of specific programs, and let me get to my page so I say this correctly. It is split up into statute into five categories. 56% of the funding is required to be used for energy conservation programs for homes and businesses. 17% of the funding is required to be spent on securing renewable resources, power generation. 10% of the money goes for energy conservation in schools, and that particular fund is directed to the educational service districts in coordination with the Department of Energy, which is required to oversee energy audits before any of that money could be spent. 12% of the money is directed to the Housing and Community Services Department for weatherization of low-income homes, and 5% was again directed to the Housing and Community Services Department for construction rehabilitation of housing, low-income housing. So the money is fairly clearly earmarked in the legislation as where it should go. Two things about that. One is that some people have concerned that the 3% charge is new. And I will tell you that that's not the case. Since the 1970s, Oregon law has required utility companies to invest in conservation activities. And they have. And through the years, it's been up and down. In the 1990s, there were periods of times when it got as high as 5% within the utility, and there were times when it got as low as slightly under 1%, so it's been erratic. Second piece of that is, as we got into the 90s, law also required that utilities to invest or at least consider, plan for within their resource plans, which they're required to do with the Commission for Renewables. The rationale that I think is important to understand, why do we do that, is that conservation and renewables are good public policy because on the conservation charge, one of the things that we know is that we've had, or we've enjoyed as Oregonians, very low-cost power in the past, and that's because of the hydro resource. Well, the fact of the matter is that we don't have any more of that to gain, but we still have increasing electrical load growth in the state of Oregon, so we're going to have to, the question is, how do you meet that generation need the best? The issue of conservation is that that is a way, by saving energy, that you don't have to buy as much new generation. And the cost trade-off there, if you're looking to meet that load growth, if you do it through conservation effectively, and the question is, are we doing it effectively, it's going to cost you between a penny and a half and 2 cents a kilowatt hour to gain that generation of load. If you do it through other technologies, new generation, and that's mostly going to be coal, wind, or natural gas. Most of it's natural gas. That's going to cost you, at today's prices, about 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour or more. So conservation is less than half as expensive way to meet load growth as is building a new generation plant. That's the rationale behind it. The rationale for going into renewables is, frankly, hedging your bets. It's good for the environment if you're doing wind or biomass or one of those exotic pieces, solar, but it is also good in terms of we're not relying as much on one source. And I think we learned in 2001 what happens when you're over-reliant on hydropower, which we don't have a lot of choices when we had to go into the marketplace. But we're also seeing the same thing in natural gas, which is sort of the source du jour of providers across the country now. In the last 3 to 5 years, the growth in consumption of natural gas in Oregon and, in fact, in the United States has grown by almost 40%. Almost all of that growth is due to increased generation of electricity through natural gas. The effect of that growth and going into world marketplace has been that natural gas prices have gone from a unit, a measurement unit is a million BTUs. Million BTUs. I always get that number. It's a big number put together of $1.50 to $2 in year 2000 for a million BTUs. To today's prices are on the spot market are over $6. Fortunately, our companies are buying that, and they're more in the $4.50 to $5 range for most of the stuff. But the lesson learned is those prices are going up, and if you look at the growth in world demand, which we're moving into, particularly in China and India, is that number, that cost is going to go up. It's not going to go back down. So we want to diversify that base so we can levelize the risk some. That's why we do those two sources. That gets us to the question of how do we do them? When the legislation was...
Could I just a minute? I'm sure you're probably familiar with the new wave energy research project that Oregon State University is going to do. Five places in the world have been selected, and one of them is Reedsport in my district. And I'm curious, is it's more sustainable than wind, and I'm curious if there's any way that any of the public purpose money is ever used in research, such as the wave energy research project.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the fund isn't set up specifically as an R&D, research and development fund. there have been projects funded on solar, biomass, on small scale, different ones there, but I think if it was approvable technology and made sense, then it would make sense to go there. There's nothing legislatively that would preclude that. But it's probably not the best expenditure for that limited amount of money starting out. And there's quite a bit of R&D dollars out there. The Federal Department of Energy is quite interested in that, funding those grants. And as you pointed out, OSU is one of the leaders in that research, isn't it?
Thank you.
Where was I? How did we get to the trust board? The legislation, when it was created for the two pieces of funds that go for conservation and renewables, the legislative direction was that money should go to a non-governmental entity. And this is, I have to admit, this was before my time on the commission, but the commission started out with that charge seeing, is there somebody else in the Northwest who could do that job, was willing to do that job, and they talked to a number of the not-for-profits in the area and ended up creating the Energy Trust of Oregon as a nonprofit because, frankly, no one else was willing to do the job or were in a position to do that.
Really quick, how are board members selected?
Board members, the initial board was appointed by the Public Utility Commission in coordination with the Department of Energy. Once appointed, it's a 501(c) non-governmental entity, and to keep that arm's reach, they are a self-appointing board just like any other nonprofit at this time.
Would it be possible for this committee to get a copy of the bylaws of the 501(c)?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
You do have a list of the board members that in the packet that I handed out today. The current board...
And let me add to that, the articles of incorporation and the bylaws. Excuse me.
Okay.
Yeah.
We will certainly get that for you.
Mr. Chair, there are a number of us that have an interest in that, so...
We'll make sure we get that distributed to the full committee.
They have, while it is, since you raised the issue on board membership, while they are self-appointing, they have been very good in reaching out to consumer groups and to us. I mean, every time they ask us to help them in terms of coming up with board members. And they've also done a very good job, I believe, in talking with the industrial customers, AOI, and others, and seeking board members to do that. While there is no requirement, at least none that I'm aware of, in their articles of incorporation or that specifying who would be members on the board. The board is a 12-member board. Two of those members are ex officio, and those two members are one of the commissioners. Currently, that's Commissioner John Savage, who we asked to represent us on the board because John has probably more experience than anybody else in Oregon government in conservation as the former head of the Department of Energy. And secondly, a designee senior manager of the Department of Energy that's selected by the director of that department. So we have that on there. The other members include, and I'll just run through them if because you seem to have an interest in that. Tom Foley is the current president. Tom has over 26 years of experience in the energy industry, was a senior staff member for the Northwest Power Planning Council, and has been a consultant to a number of energy companies. His specialty is in conservation and energy efficiency work. John Reynolds is a professor emeritus of architecture with the University of Oregon. John has a worldwide reputation in solar energy and energy conservation activities. Julie Hammond is the manager of an insurance company in Bend. John Klosterman is a vice president of manufacturing for Rejuvenations. This is a architectural supplier in Portland. Rick Applegate is with the City of Portland. He's their Superfund manager, and before that he worked with, the Power Council also. Jason Eisendorfer is the representative from Citizens Utility Board. Debbie Cheechin is the co-owner of Interworks, a construction company that specializes in commercial renovation I want to say she's from Medford, but I can't recall, Mr. Chair. Rick Kroon is the energy manager, facility manager for Intel in Oregon. Vicki Liske is from Klamath Falls and is the manager of a 1,500-acre ranch down there that uses geothermal heated water to do greenhouses and tropical fish and kind of the environmental, I guess that's what you'd call that, agricultural business. Cheryl Perrin is a retired senior executive with Fred Meyer Corporation, currently is the executive director of a national not-for-profit. And again, as I said, John Savage and from our organization, and Bill Nesbitt is a senior manager with DOE, or the other board members. And they're currently seeking two additional board members, Steve Schell, who is the initial president of the corporation, is an attorney in Portland, formerly served on the Energy Siting Council, has just stepped off the board for other reasons, and that position's open, and they have one other. So if the committee has recommendations on who would make sense, I'm sure they would be more than welcome near those. We worked really hard. I have personally worked to try and get more private sector customers on the board and to get make sure that we had a good geographic spread throughout the Pacific Core and PGE territory. And frankly, it's a very active, aggressive board, and it's a big demand on a volunteer's time. You know, myself serving on a number of boards, I know what that can do to you. And if you're from Klamath Falls or Medford and have to drive to Portland, that can be an inconvenience. So it can be hard to do that.
One thing I'd like to point out, and I just do this simply for clarification, is one area of the state that's not represented but has tremendous Portland General Electric assets is North Central Oregon, primarily the Boardman-Hermiston area, where there's billions of dollars of PGE assets located.
Mr. Chairman, I have personally tried to find people over here. I would be very welcoming of recommendations.
So, thank you.
So that's the board, and as we said, it is self-appointing. They have a series of rigorous committees, and in addition to just the board, they have two large technical, or if you use the term peer review committees, that help them develop policies, one in the conservation side and one in the renewables, that are sort of like a who's who in the business in Oregon. So you have a good mix there. The delivery of services, the trust does not deliver services directly itself. It contracts those services out, establishes programs and contracts it out. They have over 400 Oregon businesses that they work through who are actually the delivery arm in the communities throughout the state. That's primarily on the conservation side where most of the activities is. On the renewable side, it's just a scale of magnitude. The conservation are fairly small. Most of the projects, the residential, as you get up to a large project, and one that comes to mind to me is like Blue Heron Paper Company. They just did a major project with Blue Heron. It was a multi-million-dollar deal, very complicated. That one, obviously, is a project that the board of directors gets very involved in with the staff, and there's more analysis. You have a different issue on the renewables. Each of those are going
to
be unique.
Really quick, I want to go back to the Blue Heron project. Without getting into the details of the project, mm-hmm. because of confidentiality, share with this committee, how do you balance the public funds with the need for confidentiality in developing a project? Because that project has been brought to my attention as one to review.
Sure.
But at the same time, I understand the difficulty you're under in terms of a private developer trying to move something forward.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that's a project that probably has been more under the public microscope than any other. I think most of the information about that has been in the public domain. Blue Heron's not insistence, but wanting to make sure that people were aware of that, because they view it as a very positive thing. The technical analysis of that and some of the financing, mainly the confidentiality piece, is more in terms of the finances of the company and protecting that. Ms. Chair, I know you're familiar doing as a loan officer in your past lives on that. It's the same kind of things where you're looking at the financials of the company and personal financial statements of that. That stuff is generally what's protected. The nature
you're able to talk about the nature of the project, how funds from the energy trust are utilized, but you're not able to talk about financials of the business or of the personnel involved.
That's true.
You're not able to talk about their credit.
Correct.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
How about the performance of the project? Because as I said yesterday, in some cases, because it's an alternative energy, there may be instances where it's higher. But when I queried the trust, and I will admit this was some time ago, when I queried the trust about getting the performers on a project that was already in place down in the Pearl District, I was told that basically that stuff sealed in the vault, even after the project was in place. And maybe things have changed. I'll admit time has passed, and I would be very glad if it had changed. But I'm making the assumption that the reason it was sealed in the vault was that because there had been a higher price paid with a longer amortization for alternative energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I know we've had, as I said yesterday, we've had that discussion with the trust a lot in the last year, and one of the modifications we made to our grant was specifically, you know, I kind of perhaps flippantly have said I never want to hear the term confidentiality again. But there are some legitimate, as we were talking yesterday, things to be clear there. I don't know the past projects. I do believe in the early years some of the contractual agreements that were signed with some of the participants had more exclusions are protected in them than I would find acceptable today. So some of that stuff in terms of the technicals, although I don't think we should have that problem with is the project performing as expected. And if there's a specific one, I'd be happy to go and get the information and take a look at it, see what's going on. But I'm fumbling here because I don't know what there was in the past. I don't believe that's true of anything going forward.
Is each negotiation a one-off negotiation, or is there a standard contract that's used, a letter of engagement, something that indicates the relationship between an applicant, a successful applicant for assistance, and the trust?
Okay. Senator, the answer is there's standard contract language. Particularly the smaller contracts, it's just a standard contract that you'd see in most business opportunities. The larger ones, if you're doing a renewable projects, which can be very large projects, they would have standard language, but generally the I always think of them as the attachments or the work plans that are attached to those may be individualized. Those would speak more not to the terms of the business deal, but more to the specifics of you know, this is what's expected, and this is where the dollar volume is coming from.
And if
those two should be, excuse me, Senator, those two, that piece of it, I believe, is public information.
Follow up?
Yeah, if the chair would indulge me, I'm going to have to excuse myself, regrettably, for a conflict in a second. But one other question that the chair posed the other day, and I'm not sure that I heard the answer, and it may be in this packet that I haven't reviewed. And that is the methodology by which applicants enter the portal of the trust. What is that first? Is it a letter of interest? Is it an application form? I know, for example, that if I'm going to make an application for a grant from the Meyer Memorial Trust, their processes are very clearly outlined. I know exactly what happens. I know what the trigger mechanism is to get me in front of an officer if an officer is assigned. And I didn't hear the answer to the chair's question about how do I bring a project forward for consideration by the trust and what process attaches as it moves through the decision-making chain up to a point where somebody at the trust, and I don't know whether it's the board or a single person, says, yes, this is something that we'd like to invest in for the following objective criteria.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm going to give you a multiple answer here, not intending to mislead. Simple projects, home weatherizations, some of that, the refrigeration program for that they operate in in conjunction with the Restaurant Association. More of those are laid out fairly clearly, and the application process is more through a vendor and has immediate criteria and evaluation like that. As you move to the larger and more difficult, those are more of a, some of its requests for proposals specifically, but they have also intentionally and with, frankly, the Commission's encouragement, have had an open season saying if somebody's got a great idea that's going to save a lot of power cheaply, we want to have a process that you can come to do that. That's going to be longer, as you would expect, to do that, but I think they can move them, or have moved them fairly quickly. The Blue Heron project, I think, moved in a matter of a couple or a few months. But that process, because of the detailed nature of that, is going to go through, again, there's some standards that they have in place. It's going to move through a professional peer reviewing process with a recommendation to a board committee, project committee, that in turn will recommend to the board of directors, and they're going to hold it up against their benchmarks and say, is this going to give us the return that we expect? And there's also the typical business kinds of things. Does this make sense from, you know, a business background in terms of is it a stable company and that sort of thing?
Well, thank you. Let me ask a question on that, on the business background. I look at the board members, and every one of them is credentialed in a very, very sophisticated way, if you will. But I don't see any credentials on here that would tell me that someone has the ability at looking at a corporate credit report and understanding what they're reading.
Well, I'm not sure that I would agree with you. I may be wrong. Someone like Cheryl Perrin, who is a senior executive with Fred Meyer for many, many years, I suspect she's used to looking at balance sheets. I think Rick Kroon, who's a corporate manager for Intel, probably has that experience. Mr. Klosterman, who was vice president, and I believe he oversees the finances for Rejuvenation, I think has some experience of that.
Okay. Thank you. That's what I wanted to hear. It sounds like then you've got a very good balance between folks who understand the numbers and folks who truly understand the industry.
I think so, Mr. Chair. And I'll be honest at the start. At the start, the focus was on people who had some background in the industry itself, because you were building a new corporation with a specialty and wanted to have people that were very seasoned, like Mr. Foley, for example. We're in the third year, as that has unrolled, frankly, at my urging, we've got to get more of a business balance onto the board and spread that out some. So I think that's changing, but you've got a young corporation that's, you know, gone through the startup phase and is evolving, and frankly, as more staff has come on. The staff team, they've got a good business background on the finance side, so I think there's a lot of talent there, both on the board and on that side.
Would it be possible, going back to Senator Johnson's question, to request of the board that they have staff just develop a disclosure of confidentiality statement that says, this is what you will, please know when you make application, this amount of information will be disclosed, this information will not be disclosed. Please sign down below. I know that's what USDA does when it does its financings, and they go up to $25 million.
Right.
They have a process to deal with that exact same issue.
Okay. I think they may have that, but let me see what they've got, and if they haven't, that's a good suggestion.
Well, and I might suggest if they do, you could just provide it to myself and the committee, so that way Senator Johnson could see what those parameters are.
So. Be happy to do that.
Perfect.
So, Mr. Chair, I think that gets us to the Energy Trust in terms of how it was, how it came to be. One of the questions I think you've had and others have had is, what's the PUC oversight of that? Because it's a large program. I mean, this is.
Actually, one of the questions I would have is I see that they're audited. Do those become public documents?
I'm assuming that they're public documents because they're filed with us, and anything we have is a public document.
Could this committee just get a copy of the management letter?
Sure.
And then I assume that the staff has written a response to the management letter, and that response is probably to the board of directors.
Right.
If we could get a copy of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and as you mentioned, one of our grant requirements is that they have a independent financial audit every year. Probably more relevant to one of the questions you just raised is that when we created the trust, one of the requirements is that they have an independent management audit after their first 2 years of operation. That has just been completed, and I either signed the letters and they're on the way to you, or they will be shortly. I can't recall where it's at. We just got the final copy of that in the last couple of months. And I'll tell you that the management audit was very complimentary of the trust. So they've done a good job.
Could we get a copy of the management letter that goes with the management audit?
I think that's either on the way or you have it already.
Got it. Okay. Okay.
Other pieces than that, and again, I think we obviously took this very seriously. We set a benchmark that we would measure them by that basically were based on good performance based on what's historically in the area. That's in the packet. But how we manage our process with them to make sure that we have the information to protect the ratepayers' money is one, I think at the start we have a staff person that's part of his assignment is to work with them, but Commissioner Savage is on the board, as I said, and he sees all the materials and gets that. We get quarterly budget reports and finance reports and program activity reports. They actually, the trust makes an oral presentation at a public meeting to us quarterly. We also get an annual report, and we review and approve their strategic plan and annual operating plan as well. Then we do the annual audit, as we said, and we have the management audit that we just completed, and that grant agreement requires that would be replicated every 5 years as long as the trust is in activity. So we're keeping a close control on it. The other thing, that it's an evergreen contract, meaning that we have the right to renew it or stop it at any time, but there's some lead on that. We are, since we're 3 years into the program, we are holding a public session on that. I believe it's scheduled for April for renewal on the contract to give the public an opportunity to comment on that as well.
Let me ask a question, Commissioner. Going back to an earlier comment you made, you talked about if you encourage the public, if they have a good idea on saving energy, to come forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at this Energy Trust case studies list.
Mm-hmm.
And I see every one of them is a great project. How do you manage the process so you're not creating expectations to where you're then having to go back and tell folks, unfortunately, we don't think your idea is as great as another? Because I think that's part of where Senator Johnson and even part of my questions earlier are stemming from, to people who have come to you thinking they had a great idea but didn't measure up.
Mr. Chair, I think the experience to date has been that there certainly have been projects that don't meet the benchmarks requirements. And as Margie Harris, director of the trust, was saying to the committee today, you know, there's ideas that come forward where they will say, that's a wonderful idea, but it's not an idea that meets our purpose.
At what
purpose
do you tell them that?
Again, it's going to depend on the project. I think we're probably talking about larger ones. It would be after they've applied and it's got to the board of directors. So probably application process, probably a month, 2 months into it. But they're going to. This should not come as a surprise because there's active discussion with the staff. Usually those people are involved in that process along the way. And the trust has gotten to a point where I think they have some fairly clear guidelines.
In the application, is it a pre-application or is it an extensive application that you submit one time?
It's going to vary by project, but it generally has some fairly specific criteria that you're looking at. I'd be happy to get a copy of the packet or the RFP.
Well, the question I have is I wonder, without knowing the process, but just thinking of the issue that I personally know, I wonder if there's a way of developing a pre-application process where people in 1, 2, maybe up to 5 pages can submit, here's what we're applying for, then the Energy Trust can review that and say, yes, this merits further, or no, okay, it doesn't. Rather than trying to take someone through a process where their hopes every day get built up,
sure,
and then it gets cut off.
Mr. Chair, I'm feeling somewhat inadequate in describing this. You know, that we're starting to get into the details of their operation that I don't run, but I want to be clear that it depends on what you're trying to do with the program. On the conservation side, it's frankly more clear-cut because you've got established programs, you know, whether that's the industrialization, you know, they're all targeted at saving energy. So, you know, you have different things and operating things. Those answers come pretty quick. I think what you're trying to describe is things that are more on the renewable side, like, you know, a new biomass process or a new wind generator or the wave thing like that. Those are fairly unique, and the way they tend to come in is, like most of us that have done grant work in the past, you sort of are thumbing through the indexes, finding sources. Most of that starts with a telephone call. Hey, I got this really great idea. Let's talk about it. And I think it starts that way, and then I try to determine, does this make sense to get into the process mill to do it? And as part of that discussion, there would be, this is the kind of savings at this kind of a cost that we typically look at. Are you going to fit there? Now, I think legitimately you're going to have some...
See, the problem is that the trust problem becomes our problem,
mm-hmm,
because the citizenry doesn't distinguish that this is now a 501c3 federally recognized tax-exempt nonprofit, and when they have a problem, they call us, and they expect us to do something. And so somehow we have to create a mechanism either to enhance the public awareness that, you know, until session comes,
mm-hmm,
this is a nonprofit corporation under a grant agreement.
Yeah. It's really, I understand what you're getting at, Mr. Chair. It is in government circles, it's a different arrangement in that we're talking about an expenditure of money that is not tax dollars. This is money that never flows into the state of Oregon's treasury. This is a commitment that the utilities and the ratepayers are making, and so the relationship, the money flows directly from the utility to the trust to perform a service. And we get involved in it as a commission through the oversight of the utility operations and protection of the ratepayers. So it's kind of a... It ain't your normal business cycle.
You can see where we get pulled in because we're having this conversation today.
But, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I mean, is it fair to characterize this relationship, Lee, between the trust and the commission as arm's length and not supervisory? You don't really have an oversight function? Is that a fair characterization?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Wesson, not exactly. We do, at least I feel we have an oversight responsibility. We do have the right to terminate the relationship and say to the utilities we're going to switch that to somebody else. But it is arm's reach in terms of how we manage that is not on a project-by-project basis. We can't do that. We manage it on an outcomes basis and an overall. We have, as I said, we have some direct involvement by having a member on the board of directors, but again, it's a non-voting member because we're trying to keep that separation between government, if you will, and the private operation. But part of the reason to go to a private company was to have the freedom, the standard business freedom for them to operate in a business environment and not be bound by all government procurement and all of those rules. I mean, that was a policy decision that was made by the legislature to use non-governmental. But you would have had the same thing in the past when these programs were operated by the utility. Actually, there was less oversight for ratepayers under that system than you have now.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to inarticulately say is that, yes, you have a relationship and there is obviously a nexus, but you do not have project-by-project oversight.
That's correct.
Right. And I think that's where the chair is, but that's the way it is. That's the law.
So, Mr. Chair, I think it was helpful to me to think of it in a different context. I think we traditionally think of this as in terms of a spending of money and project and buying things. It's easier to think of this, I believe, and think of it as we're buying generation capacity for the consumers. And the question is, what's the cheapest or most effective way to get that capacity? This is just like going out and us approving Pacific Core to build a new gas-fired generator. This is just a different way to do it. We're doing it in chunks. But you...
No, I understand that. Yeah. I just know that when the Energy Trust has a problem, it becomes our problem. And somehow, if we could figure out a way of helping Oregonians further understand that this is now an arm's length transaction.
Okay.
And again, I don't know the solution. I just know when I get the phone call.
Well, Mr. Chair, I hope you're not getting too many of those. And if you are, please call me.
Really quick, I'm going
to interrupt. I'm trying to get rid of those.
I'm going to interrupt. We have a group of students with us. Where are you folks from?
Highland Park Middle School,
Beaverton. Good old Beaverton.
Morgan.
Well, your guess of Representative Avakian.
Well, actually, my district is just north of you. I'm over with Meadow Park, but Highland Park is a great school too.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, thank you and welcome. You're very well served by your neighbor, Representative Avakian. So, why don't we continue, Commissioner?
Well. I lost my train of thought.
Well, I think we just kind of summed up the relationship between the commission, the trust, and the commission's site or project-specific relationship. That's where I think we were.
So, in essence, our relationship is to try and get the biggest bang for the buck as we can. I try to describe it and just be very concise to people as to saying what I really want to do is to keep for ratepayers from having to buy more expensive power. And that's there are two beneficiaries of these programs. One, obviously, is the beneficiary if they come out and do an energy audit of Representative Avakian's home and say, we think we can save you 1,000 kilowatts by doing insulation, replacing these windows, and we'll pay you to do that because we want to get that 1,000 kilowatts. That saves the representative some money. But importantly, when we do that 50,000 times, that saves all of the ratepayers of PG or Pacific Core money. That's how we do it. That's how we keep it down. I did want to touch some on, just to give you a quick highlight on what we have, the performance today. We've been talking a lot about the process, but let me just give you some of where we've at in just a couple of years. Since the start of the program, the Energy Trust has made investments and helped 50,000 Oregon households save energy. In the last 2 years, we've saved enough electricity to supply the yearly needs, electricity needs of 48,000 homes. That's a big savings. The investment has saved ratepayers $26 million on their electric bills. The programs are cost-effective, as I said. The cost is between 1.5 and 1.7 cents per kilowatt hour, which is about half of what a new kilowatt of generation cost. And another measurement we've out there on the renewable side is we've invested in bringing online 41 megawatts of wind power, which too bad Representative Smith's not here. It's in Representative Smith's district. Mr. Chair, you just missed my comment. I said one of the outcomes we had was generating 41 megawatts of wind power in your district. And we invested in bringing that online. So.
That they promptly shipped to mine.
But there's been some other ones that are fairly innovative, from the solar panels on the top of this building to the solar array, largest in the state, on Kettle Foods, which is out near the freeway in Salem here, generates about a third of their energy capacity, and a similar array down on two Pepsi facilities in Klamath Falls and Lakeview. So there's a diversity there. We're also getting into the, as I said, some of the biomass facilities. There's been some examples of working with municipalities getting energy savings in their sanitary sewer system, which saves energy, but also in strapped times for local governments, saves them money on their bills as well.
Let me ask you a question. How do businesses find out about this opportunity to apply to the energy trust?
Again, it varies, and a good example is the project that the trust has with the Oregon Restaurant Association, getting and dealing with coolers and lighting and that. The marketing arm for that is the Restaurant Association.
If I went to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department website, would I see a link to the Energy Trust?
I don't think you would there, but I think you would get information if you were a member of AOI. AOI's done a couple of stories in their newsletters on it. They're fairly supportive of it. And also the industrial customers, if you ask Ken Cannon, their members are very involved. Blue Heron is one of theirs. Huge savings there.
If I went to the Housing and Community Services Department, would I be able to find a link?
You know, I don't think so.
I think those are two areas where we need to work on in the interim to make sure that there's cross-connection, if you will, between the partners.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Berger.
One of the things that industries do as well, they notify businesses that are within that industry. For instance, we can take motor oil now and use it, you know, and we had to buy the equipment, but we were notified we could buy that equipment and heat by that manner. And so I think industries themselves help you understand alternate ways of using energy. And I don't know, but I would suspect many automobile dealerships use that form of heat.
That's a good point. Mr. Chair, I think most of the efforts at marketing have gone through the 400 trade alliances that they have with businesses trying to do that. It's a quicker way if you're the Home Depots and the Lowe's and that. But that's a good suggestion. You would find that linkage if you went to the Department of Energy's site, which would be, I would think, for most Oregonians, that's probably where you might start if you were thinking about that. But it's a good point.
I've been corrected, and I think appropriately so. I think it'd be incumbent upon those departments to make sure that they're linked to you, or to the trust, excuse me, to the Energy Trust. But nonetheless, perhaps you folks could initiate the phone call.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I think I've almost beat this horse to death.
Okay. Is there any more questions on the Energy Trust?
No.
Nope. Why don't we...
There are case studies in there that I thought would be of interest to you.
Very good.
Some of that. So with that, Mr. Chair, if you'd like, we'll just sort of move on down the list here. And
why don't we move into the performance measures, point number two.
And, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how you want to do that. You described it yesterday as giving us advice from the committee as to...
Well, why don't I...
What would be relevant from your perspective, you know?
We'll turn to Monica. She can kickstart this, and then I guess we as a committee can decide how we want to proceed from there.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, I think what we heard yesterday was that there was a desire on the part of the subcommittee to get... performance measures for the Energy Trust, and I think in the first packet that they had for you on page about 3, there are some performance measures there. I don't know if you want to go over those specifically to see if you're fine with those or just have them continue to develop and potentially implement those into the agency's report to the legislature. The second concept that folks seem to be interested in, and I know the co-chairs were, was again trying to get at some managerial performance measures for the agency. And I think the subcommittee yesterday was mostly comfortable with just having them do that work in the interim and report into the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. I don't know if you want to have further discussion on specific items you'd like to see, or you just want to leave that discussion with the agency and LFO and JLAC for the interim. Whatever your pleasure.
Okay. Leave it. Senator Berger, what would be your opinion on this?
Well, you know, I've had a hard time getting my arms around performance measures that are used to benefit those outside of the agency, or and I've made the comment. In fact, I made it to the buyer today that I think we're searching for some kind of measurement to hold on to. I just don't know that performance measures, but he said it, they were certainly willing to match whatever performance measures that we wanted to do, because they too would like some type of measurement. So I think just to proceed with the performance measures that have been given to them, I think they've already worked some of those out.
Okay. Senator Westland.
Mr. Chair, I am very much of the opinion that in conjunction with the Commission and the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, that a joint or a single product, collaborative product, produced by both the Commission and JLAC, a set of performance measures should be established in cooperation with this committee.
Perfect. We have Senator Morris coming in, and yesterday he and Senator Johnson shared with the Commission a performance measure that they're sharing with each of the agencies, departments, and commissions. And I don't know if Senator Morris should be prepared to share that, or if we could just have the Commission go back to yesterday's tapes to remind themselves.
I think, Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson was very articulate in stating what those objectives would be, but essentially what we're interested in doing is to make sure that boards and commissions are in fact engaged in the continuous improvement process and prescriptively looking at certain issues that would assure themselves and could in fact represent to us as legislators in the budget review process that they have in fact been engaged and been helping to initiate continuous improvement in these agencies. And that's the intent of what we're talking about, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Just really quick, I'm going to use the chair's prerogative one more time. I noticed we've had more students come in. We already recognized you. Where are the students who came in on the second half? Where are you from?
Same place.
Got it. And you know that this is your neighbor, Representative Avakian, who serves you very well. Okay. What we're doing just really quickly is we're going through the Public Utility Commission's budget. And they do a very good job, but part of what our priority is, or our process is we're going through and we're prioritizing their activities. And we're trying to determine what's the very most important and what's the very least important, and then we're going to decide, based on that list, what should we fund, what should we not fund. And then also what we're doing is we're saying, what do we expect of this commission? What do we expect them to perform and to do? And so we're helping them, and they're helping us figure out how we should measure whether or not they're using taxpayer dollars and utility dollars and surcharge dollars in an appropriate way. And so as much as folks would like to have back and forth kind of discussion, what you're seeing is almost a partnership of trying to figure out how do we make the Public Utility Commission work. So that's where we are. By the way, what grade are you in?
Eighth.
I've got an eighth grader. Heppner Middle School. All right. Why don't we proceed forward? I think what we heard, Commissioner, was that we would ask that LFO work with you, and that you and LFO would work with JLAC during the interim to come up with performance measures that will work for everyone, and then have you report to JLAC on that work.
Be happy to do that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, in looking at best practices, which is what I see that Senator Morris and Senator Johnson have put together, they really are a different kind of thought process than the performance measures. So I don't know, do you want those interacted in any way?
Let's turn to Senator Morris. This is his concept.
Excuse me.
The performance, yours is best practices, which I totally can see what you're going for in the checklist for those, and I can follow that, and it's an overlay, and I presume that you have that list, Commissioner Beyer. But performance standard is something different to me from best practices. So do you see those interrelated, or how do you see those?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, what I think is the performance measures become a component of the governance issue.
Okay.
And to make certain that, in fact, we are looking at these measures. And one thing, Mr. Chairman, I did want to point out, much of the data that has been presented to us in performance measures is dated to 2003. There's very little data, Commissioner Beyer, with respect to 2004, which would lead me to ask the question, are we in fact using the performance measures? And if they're not current, then they're not likely to be of much value.
Well, I think, Senator Morse, that was part of the concern that the co-chairs had, and I think part of the concerns this committee has raised. And I think the commission has raised this same concern, and so I think part of what we want to do is in the interim is help them find those measures that will work, because obviously what we have before us isn't it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, the budget instructions at the time we had to put this together to get it to DHS and through the governor's process, that's what we had was 2003. We do have 2004 measures. But again, when this was put together, all we had was 2003. In the interim, we've had 2004, and we'd be happy to supply them to you. We do use them. We do have them updated.
Why don't you provide those to the committee? We'll get those dispersed. And Senator Morse, you've kind of become our lead on performance measures. I don't know if you'd be willing to work with us on that.
Sure.
Okay.
Is that
okay?
Okay.
Ready? Why don't we proceed to point number three, where we were just actually on point number three. It was just we wanted you to provide a copy of the AG's retainer agreement. I don't think we need you to walk through that. I think it was more just for our own edification. You were going to give us just a quick explanation on how Small Water Company operates. Again, I think we covered that yesterday, and I feel pretty comfortable with it. I was the one who raised that question as an individual from Eastern Oregon. We have irrigation districts and municipalities and special districts who offer this, and if they don't get it, you dig your own hole and until you hit water. But if the committee would like us to go through that, we can.
No, I agree. Let's move on.
Move on? Okay. Representative Richardson asked the question, if you could share with us a little more information on your management to staff ratio. And I think that's a point we should discuss.
Well, be happy to, Mr. Chair. I wasn't exactly sure what the representative's questions were with response to that. This is a structure that has been in place for many years. And I think one of the discussions that we actually had last year, well, here we go, this is one of the discussions we had last year was the unique, perhaps unique...
It should be. Oh, please continue.
Oh, the unique nature of our regulatory function where we have... we have a number of areas that we're into that have small work units, and essentially I would say that we have three large units that have what I would consider, if you will, peer managers in them. Mr. Willis, our utility director, and to some extent our chief law judge, although he works cases just like the others, but his job is coordinating. Most of the other positions that we have in there, probably fair to call them team coordinators, and whether it's our team of auditors, our finance specialist section, our gas section, our safety section, or so forth. They're just fairly unique units, and they function more as team leaders within that. But I'm not sure how you want to proceed in discussing that. I notice the representative has joined us again.
It's a great answer. Mr. Chair, I think that if I were in your seat, I would give the same kind of answer. In looking at the detailed chart, you have a lot of responsibility. You have a lot of various aspects to have such a low ratio between management and the staff has financial consequences to the financial resources, and it's always something that needs to be looked at. And I guess the question I would have is, in the last couple of years, have you spent any time reviewing your structure? And if so, what were your findings? And if not, would it be appropriate to back off, as all major corporations do, every 5 years and reanalyze how they're structured, whether the structure needs to be changed in any way? Because if we just continue to go the way it's been in the past, management costs go up, and it may not be as efficient as it could be.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, that's a good question, and we have done some of that. We haven't done, I guess we haven't done a stand back completely and reviewed the whole organization that way, but since Commissioner Savage and Commissioner Baum and I have come on, we have discussed some of that, and quite frankly have made some changes. And we'll probably do more as we're looking ahead, and primarily in the telecommunications side, because that industry is changing, and we think as we move ahead the next couple of years, how we do that business is going to change substantially. I couldn't tell you today how that is, because it's kind of a moving target with both technology and with what the federal government through Congress as well as the federal communications companies are doing. But I suspect that we're going to see some big changes there, and frankly, I suspect we're going to see some reductions in staff over time as we go into there. I don't have that same belief on the energy side just because of the nature of that practice on that side there.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Barr, I'm satisfied if you're just representing to us that during this next biennium that you and the other commissioners will look at your structure, and as you're saying that you will do, you're going to be focusing on IT, and that if the current structure is not as efficient as it could be, that you would be willing to address that and come back at the next meeting that we have in 2 years and be able to let us know what could be done for efficiency's purposes.
I feel very comfortable with that.
Thank you.
Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As protector of the people, your responsibilities can ebb and flow. We have legislation even before us now that is being around the building that would have to do with whether a utility will be consumer-owned in Oregon. And that will have a lot to do with how much responsibility or added responsibility you may have. And so I think it is very difficult. I do think the staffing ratio becomes more important in other organizations or agencies other than yours. And so I think there have been some oversight in looking at staff ratio that we've said, and Commissioner Byer, you probably have been in that position yourself in the Senate where you look at it and say, what is this? Mm-hmm. And so I think that in fairness, we try to ask a lot of the same questions of everyone who comes, but I do think that your responsibility, I would be of great caution to you in this changing environment right now, that the commission stay very solid and wait and see what is going to pass through the legislature in terms of that.
Mr. Chair, or Senator Berger, that hasn't been lost on me as we look at this. And in honesty, the commissioners have discussed that, and we recognize changes in a lot of different areas
right. Are
coming, and we need to, as Representative Richardson suggests, we need to take a look at that. And certainly one of our jobs, and particularly one of my jobs as chairman of the commission, is to make sure that we have the management in place to do the job and not too much management in place. So we will do that, and I appreciate the committee's concerns on that. I know that's your job.
A follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berger.
Yes, and I think that in Oregon, I am a bit captured by the WAVE research. Maybe it will be like Alwyn research that didn't work on the coast, that everybody thought, well, we just have wind all the time. Well, we don't. Mm. And another thing, they couldn't tell when the wind was going to come up. Now they have a 10-hour prediction on the wave energy. If indeed this were to be successful, even in a small enough way to run one plant, that would be a tremendous step forward in progress and make us less dependent in Oregon. And so I hope that you will watch that procedure as it goes along to see what your own evaluation of it is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, anything that we can do to move off of fossil fuels is an incredible benefit to ratepayers, because we know where fossil fuels are going.
That's right.
Right. I'm not sure exactly where we're at. Do you have more to give?
We do not. TAS has yet to do theirs.
Mr. Chair, there was no one signed up for public testimony, so we can proceed from there if you wish.
All right. Would you like to address this?
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, this is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be presenting to you an overview of the governor's budget for the Public Utility Commission for the 2005-2007 biennium. Yes. And you all should all have handouts. Look like this in front of you all. So if you all would refer to that. You will turn to page 2. You all have seen this these charts before. This shows the recommendation, governor's recommended budget for the entire consumer and business services program area, which consists of 17 state agencies, including the Public Utility Commission. The governor's recommended budget for the consumer and business services program area has $840.1 million of total funds. There's only one state agency with general fund here, and that's the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Public Utility Commission's budget is 17% of the recommended budget for the program area. If you all will now move to page 3, this lists the four governance principles that support the agency's functions. As you are aware, this time the governor underlined 6 principles to support his budget. And the principles that support the agency's functions are those relating to economic development, government efficiency and accountability, health and basic services, basic needs, and public safety. Moving along to page 4, the chart there shows the various fund types that make up this agency's budget. I would like to draw your attention to the other funds, the 24% that you see. That is, those are the funds that really fund the agency's operations. And the main sources of the other funds are the fees paid by utilities, Oregon utilities, the water companies, electric, gas, and telecommunication utilities all pay fees to the Public Utility Commission. Secondly, there's also a surcharge on all telephone lines. This is to support the residential services program. There's a 10-cent per line surcharge. So those two are the main funding sources for the agency's operations. You see a 0% under federal funds. The agency has about $422,000 of federal fund dollars to support gas line safety inspections, and you heard about that yesterday. Now, the large chunk you see, the 78%, the other funds done limited, that's the Oregon Universal Service Fund. And Commissioner Beyer talked about this yesterday. The 1999 legislature, through Senate Bill 622, established this fund, and the source of revenue for this fund is all telecommunication providers in the state give an assessment for this fund, and the funds are used to subsidize basic telecommunication costs in high-cost areas. Moving along to page 5, the agency's budget has 3 program units. The utility program you see has 82% of the budget. Residential Service Protection Program has 7%, and Policy and Administration has 11%. The reason why you see the 82% under the utility regulation is because the Oregon Universal Service Fund is all under that program.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Avakian.
Just in case anybody else was confused, I think your page numbers are off by one from ours.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh.
That was page six by my packet that you said was page five.
Okay.
I mentioned just because I saw folks flipping through
pages. Oh, that's helpful. Thank you.
I apologize for that.
You got me looking there for a while.
Oh. Okay, then I'm in your page six. So this just shows the different program units, and I just went through that. Now moving over to your page 7, this shows the various expenditure categories. As you can see, personal services consists of 14% of the budget. And the personal services, this pays for the employees, employee gross compensation, includes wages, benefits, unemployment, insurance assessments, pay differential, and other personal costs. Services and supplies consists of 11% of the budget. And these are non-personnel expenses necessary for agency operations like rent, personal services contracts, state government service charges, personal computers. A very small percentage of the agency's budget, capital outlay, they just have around $68,000 is for capital outlay, and this refers to non-routine expenditures that have to be at least 2 years with an initial value of more than $5,000. The large chunk, the 75%, the special payments, that's again the universal service funds. These are non-limited expenditures, and what the agency does is it's just a pass-through. The agency receives these funds, and these are passed to the utilities that serve high-cost areas, which are mainly rural areas in the state. Moving along to page 8, if you look at the far right column, you'll see that in comparison to the 2003-2005 legislatively approved budget, the other funds have increased by 3.3%. Now, most of this increase is in personal services, and this is due to flexible benefits costs and the increase in the PERS contribution. The federal funds increase, you see, of 25%, and that's because the federal government is providing around $90,000 more for gas pipeline safety. And non-limited other funds, there's a huge decrease because the agency has projected that they will receive less funds under the Universal Service Fund assessments. Moving on to the last page, now the major policy issues. The governor's recommended budget recognizes the importance of the agency functions in ensuring safe and reliable service to Oregon consumers at reasonable rates. As a result, all existing programs are maintained, and the budget adds 1.5 full-time equivalent positions. One position is, you will see that in package 102, and that is for a new pipeline safety inspector. The federal government has mandated some new requirements, and this the cost of this position is about $184,000. Half of it is going to be federally funded. The other half is going to be funded with other funds. In addition, the agency is also requesting for a half-time position. This is Office Specialist 2 position. They are not requesting any additional funding for this. The agency has been using temporary student workers, and they would rather have a permanent position for this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Berger.
I have a comment and a question. One comment is that I'm sure all of you have read about some of the trials down in our part of the state with natural gas line going in. And we have been very, very fortunate to have the commission because they have been an oversight for us and a protection in many ways. So I want to say that. I'm having trouble about the trust, the public purposes money, the 3%. Where do I find it, and is it in what you've just been through?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, that does not; those funds do not go through the Public Utility Commission. The Public Utility Commission gets around $80,000 for administration of the trust, but that goes; the funds flow into a 501c. A non-profit entity, so we don't see it in any state agency budget.
Do you happen to know what that amount of money is?
I would have to refer to the agency for that.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please, Commissioner.
Senator Berger, that amount, I'm trying to put the whole thing together, the 3%. It's about $50 million a year, $100 million a biennium, and that money is ratepayer money that goes directly from the utility to the various sources. Now, the money that goes to the trust goes directly to them. The other funds that go to the Housing and Community Services Department come through the state, and I'm sorry, I can't recall whether the money to the ESDs comes through to the Department of Education or Department of Energy or not. But
so the total of follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please follow up.
So the total of $15 million a year or $30 million a biennium is the total of where it goes to all of those.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, let me correct that. Not 15, 50, 50.
50.
50.
Okay.
Yeah. And
Senator Berger, I would share with you really quick that I've requested that they send us a copy of the public trust audit that's done annually.
Uh-huh.
At least a copy of the management letter,
mm-hmm.
Along with their response to that, just so we as a committee can see the activities that are going on.
Okay.
Thank you.
So,
all right.
Yeah.
Question.
Yeah. Senator Carter.
Mr. Beyer, would you tell me about the 9 refrances? And I apologize for not being here when you went over this, but were these positions that had already been projected?
Were those positions that had already been projected from the last session and people that you used in increased workload environment? What's the circumstances around that?
Mr. Willis, would you like to?
If I may. Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I was getting to that. Yes, the governor's recommended budget includes 9 reclassifications, and it also includes establishment of a position and abolishment of a position. That's all, and you can see that in one policy package. The reason why it's in the governor's recommended budget is, one, the agency submitted the request. We sent it down to the Department of Administrative Services, Human Resource Services Division, and they evaluated the job duties. They supported it. Secondly, the Budget and Management Division, we had a discussion with the agency as to if those functions could be eliminated or if there are other people in the agencies who could take over the functions. The agency said that could not be done. Thirdly, all of these positions are currently being paid out of class. And lastly, the agency is not requesting any additional expenditure limitation. The cost for these reclasses is about $73,000, and this is coming out of their existing budget.
Thanks.
I'm done. You're wrapped up. Any other questions, comments from the committee? Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I'm looking at it's tab 1, legislative action, and it's the 72nd legislative committee report, essentially, and it's page Roman numeral 8, and it talks about the packages that took place 2 years ago. And as I compare what took place 2 years ago with what's taking place or what's recommended for now, I see, and I haven't had a chance to count them, but it looks like, you know, 8 to 12 positions were moved around last time. And as I look at them, it looks like all of them moved up into higher pay differential positions. And as I look at what's being recommended here, I see, again, a whole series of positions that are being reclassified and again moving up. And of course, there's two ways to give pay increases. One is actual dollars, and the other is change the title and to a different position. And so I'm wondering, is this a normal thing to change, 10% of your people every 2 years, or is this a unique circumstance? If you could just help us understand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, we have done quite a few reclasses. The industries that we regulate have been changing dramatically and changing in more complexity and with competition, just more issues. We have tried very hard within the Commission to try not to add more folks to try to deal with some of this, but rather reclass positions, and actually that's not the aim. It's give additional responsibilities to positions to be able to handle this additional complexity and workload that comes along with it. And that is primarily the driver both last biennium and this biennium for these reclasses.
Take one of the positions and give us an example.
Okay. In our current one, to be easier for me to talk about than trying to remember 2 years ago,
sure.
We have an individual in our consumer services section who we are asking to be reclassed up as a trainer. 10 years ago, we wouldn't have needed a trainer. The majority of the complaints and the calls that they were handling were billing complaints. I believe I made this many calls, long-distance calls. The company says I made that many, and it's too high. Those are relatively straightforward, easy complaints to deal with. Today, competition with new technology, with all the different companies involved, it is a far more complex, we get far more complex calls. They have to do with slamming and cramming. And even to find out which company is responsible, because it goes from this company to this company, is a far more arduous task, both for us and for the companies. And so we are asking for a position to be reclassed up to help train the folks beneath the trainer, as well as help train the industry on how we do things. So they understand better. They tell us how they do things so we can coordinate our efforts and their efforts better. That's one example.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, question I have, for instance, it says that you're abolishing a mail services assistant. I assume that the work that was being done by this person is no longer necessary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, it is necessary, but we had two folks in there. So we could abolish that one and reestablish that position in our business office. And that person in the reestablished position could serve as a backup to the mailroom. The mailroom work, because we're doing more and more e-filing, more and more electronic, the work in the mailroom has gone down a bit so that we feel one person with a backup can handle the mailroom work. On the other hand, because the volume of work, particularly the Universal Service Fund that was talked about and all the money that flows through that, we needed more assistance in our business office. As a matter of fact, we had an audit last year or the year before that actually was a very good audit, but they did recommend some further checks and balances within our business office. So again, without asking for a new position, we said, okay, we have a little less work in this area. Let's take that person and put them in an area where we have a little more work and reclass it, or in this case, abolish and establish.
Just very quickly, and then I want to move on. Did any of the reclassifications go down?
Mr. Chair, no, they didn't. No. All the work is going up. The complexity is going up. Mr. Chair, I might also add that we had, during the interim, between last session and this session, 5 reclasses that we did ourselves, but none of those went up. So we do look at reclasses, and if it's not a higher level of work, We don't bring it in and ask for an upward reclass. We'll reclass to a lateral position with no fiscal impact.
Thank you. Any other questions? No? Very quickly, I'm going to give the audience, as silly as this sounds, one opportunity for public testimony if anyone would like to come up. If not, we're going to close the public hearing. And we're going to open up a work session on House Bill 5063. I'm going to turn to Monica Brown, our legislative fiscal officer.
Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee, before you is a memo, format you're going to start seeing from LFO, briefly summarizing LFO's recommendations, and then you're going to see a series of reports that are out of the new Orbitz budgeting system we're seeing this time. And then the last page on that packet is the proposed or the recommendations for the performance measures that we had discussed earlier. Since we've just recently talked about the packages that are being requested, let me summarize them briefly. The governor's recommended budget would establish 3 new positions, 2.5 FTE, and abolish 1 position. Again, 1 in the pipeline safety area, and then administrative positions and 9 reclassifications. LFO's recommendation on this budget is probably simple to handle it in block. Is LFO's recommendation is to approve the governor's recommended budget as modified for the PERS rate adjustment, where there was a 0.89% reduction in the PERS rate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So move the approval of LFO's recommendation.
We have a motion to approve the LFO recommended budget. Do we have a second? Senator Morris, question?
A question.
Question.
Sure. We've been seeing this regularly in budgets, reduction in PERS rates, but yet we've had adverse court rulings. And I haven't raised this issue in other settings. Maybe Ms. Brown could shed some light on why this is happening.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, the reduction that we are assuming in here is based on, I believe, the January or February action of the PERS board, which does not incorporate the last action on the lawsuit, as most of us are aware, was sort of a split decision. There is no immediate action anticipated by the PERS board. So that, you are correct, that is not incorporated into this rate, and they're not expected to take action to adjust the rate for the next year.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Just very quickly, I'm going to, I guess we need a second.
Second, Mr. Chair.
Second. Very quickly, I just want to remind the Commission that this subcommittee is watching the Oregon Energy Trust, and we'd ask that you would watch that as well and ensure that it's being managed in a very fiduciarily appropriate manner. With no objections, going to approve House Bill 5063. We do have to take a motion, though, on the performance measures, and if Monica could walk through those with us very quickly.
Mr. Chair, if you turn to the last page of the packet, it's actually page 3 of the performance report. Pardon me, go back to page 2 of the performance measure report. I think we heard during public hearing portion two desires of the subcommittee. One, that they wanted to start seeing the performance measures for the energy trusts to be reported. So that is the first recommendation, is that they shall develop or at least incorporate those that they have worked on into the report and report to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee by August 1st, 2006 to have those approved and targets established. The second piece is, again, I think a desire of the co-chairs and the subcommittee to have measures that are more relevant to the internal management of the agency as well as the high-level measures that are currently being reported. So the second recommendation is to, again, have the agency work with LFO and the Joint Legislative Audit Committee to develop those measures and targets and report into JLAC by August 1st, 2006.
Perfect. We have LFO's recommendations on the performance measures for the Public Utility Commission. Any comments? Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the amended performance measures as just discussed by Ms. Brown.
Perfect. We have a motion from Senator Johnson. Before we get a second, we do have a question from Representative Richardson.
I have a question on proposed, it's goal number 7 is to be added. And it says that the key performance measure will be percent of complaint investigation cases open 50 days or less. And I'm wondering if that was intended to be less or more, because if we answer this one, we know how many got open less, but we don't know what the extent of those cases that were open more than 50 days and or how long. So I'm just asking you for clarification on that.
I would ask the Public Utility Commission to make note of that. And during the interim, as they're working on this with LFO and preparing to submit those to JLAC, that they'll know that is an issue worthy of their review.
Okay, that's goal 6 and goal 7.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that we had the opportunity. I know we discussed it, but I want to make sure that they're incorporated in here. What Senator Morris and I are now referring to is the best business practices performance measure. And that would include the sign-off on the legislative package by the commission, and I think we went through them. I won't bore the committee by reading them. LFO is now well aware of them, and if you have the opportunity to work with them to develop those in a way that reflects the engagement of your commission with the agency.
Any other questions or comments? No objection? So moved. Senator Carter.
I move House Bill 5063 for the Public Utility Commission to the full committee with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Carter has made a motion to move. The bill just slipped me. House Bill 5063 as amended to the full Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. See no objection.
We have a second from Senator Westland. Seeing no objection. So moved. We need a carrier to full Ways and Means.
I'll carry it, Mr. Chair.
Then we need a carrier for the House and the Senate.
They can do it.
Westland. Senator Westland.
He volunteered.
Representative Richardson will carry it on the House side. Seeing that we have no other business before us, I want to thank this committee for its patience in dealing with a inexperienced chair who told several of you that we would not be going to work session, but per the guidance of the co-chairs and vice chairs above me, we did. And I'd like to also give special thanks to Senator Carter for her guidance through this process. Seeing no other comments, we are going to be adjourned for the day.
Frank, wait a minute.